Ksuba, so let's try to pick up more or less where we left off. Just a few other observations about writing names in a Ksuba. One thing I didn't mention last time is that if you have a double name, let's say Chaim Yaakov or Reuven Shimon, then there's a kapeda that the name should, that both parts of the name should appear on the same line. You shouldn't break it up. So you shouldn't have Reuven at the end of one line and Shimon at the beginning of the next line if he has a double Shem Kodesh. So the father's name could be on the next line. You could have Ben at the end of one line and then the father's name on the next line. But if a person has a double name, Yaakov Yosef, it should be on the same line. I mentioned last time that we weren't going to talk about the details of the conventions of transliteration, but I thought maybe it's good idea anyway to just give you 3 minutes of the basics. You're not going to remember it properly, but just to have it on the record. The general way that we'll call the Ashkenazic convention for transliterating Loazi names goes more or less along the lines of the following. A kamatz sound is generally represented by an aleph. So let's say a Lawrence. The law is a kamatz, so Lawrence would be lamed aleph, the law of Lawrence. A kamatz sound is generally represented by an aleph. A patach sound, depending on how strong it is either represented by an aleph or sometimes left out entirely. So let's say say Arthur. So the R of Arthur is a patach sound, so there the that's represented by an aleph. Segel would be represented by an ayin. So in let's say Robert Resh Aleph, Beis Ayin Resh Tes. So the segel sound, sometimes you have an in between mifta, somewhere between a comment and a segel. You have to figure whether it's an aleph or an ayin. An O sound is generally represented by either an aleph or an aleph of. So let's say the name Joseph. Some write Joseph, Dalet Ayin Shin, Aleph Vav, Samach Ayin Fesophis. Some write it, we write in our best, and without the Vav in the middle, Joseph, Dalet Ayin Shin, Aleph, Samach Ayin Fesophis. Although if it's at the end of a word, so then it's a stronger O, then everyone would write it with an aleph of. So Joe, we write Dalet Ayin Shin aleph of. Joseph, we write Dalet Ayin Shin aleph samach ayin fesophis. Although Rav Nata, for example, would write Dalet Ayin Shin aleph of samach ayin fesophis. An A sound is generally represented by a single yud. So Abe, for example, would be Aleph Yud-Beis. Whereas a I sound, like Isaac, would be W. So Aleph Yud, Yud, Zion, Yud, Kuf. Then in terms of some of the letters, a J sound, an American J sound, different traditions, we write a Dalet Zion Shin. And Moshe wrote, I'm sorry?
Dalet
Zayin Shin. Rav Moshe wrote a Dalet Zayin, so Tamida Rav Moshe, Henkin also wrote a Dalet Zayin. So most nowadays write a Dalet Zayin Shin, but some write a Dalet Zayin. A T or TH sound is represented by a Tess. We don't use a Tuff, because a Tuff could also be a Suff, but a Tess can only be a Tess. So a T or TH sound would be represented by a Tess. And a P sound would be represented by a pay. Let's say you have a name Philip, so there's no such thing as a pesophis. We only have a pesophis, so Philip is written pay yud lam yud pay at the end. You know, looks a little bit funny to have a pay at the end of a word, but since it's a P sound and not a F sound, there's no such thing as a pesophis, so it has to be a pay. Michael.
Do you need these, like, Isaac, Joseph, mm-hmm. So you're saying we wouldn't convert it back to the Hebrew name, which is like Yosef?
Yeah, they don't have a Hebrew name. Or if they, not everyone has a Hebrew name. I mean, these are relevant for places also. that will come up. You'll more often have to figure out how to spell a certain location, which doesn't have a Hebrew name, than use a non-Hebrew name in Ksuba. But there are times that you write a non-Hebrew name in Ksuba and doesn't have a Hebrew name.
It was grouped religious, the name was originally Yosef, but after going to all these places, it became Joe.
The general practice is that if he has a Jewish name from birth, even if he doesn't use it in the Ksuba, we tend to write it. But sometimes people don't have a Jewish name, or they don't know their Jewish name. Then you write the Loazi name. Okay. Generally speaking, a Loazi name that, yeah?
The Ayin practice that, like, Hasidim throw in everything, they just...
No, they don't. Hasidim don't throw in more than you or I. If there's a segel, then you need an ayin there.
I've seen a lot of last names, like see the show, just by anecdotal evidence, house bags.
Yeah, so that's the proper Yiddish spelling of a last name. So if you have a Hebraic-like last name, then you can use your Hebraic-like last name, but for the convention of a first name or a place, we use the standard transliteration principles.
I'm asking, in other words, when Hasidim will spell out of New York...
I don't know why you're picking on Hasidim.
Because I've seen the Palestinian bags have much more ayin than anywhere else.
I think you're making a certain sociological evaluation without or analysis without enough of a sample.
Definitely true. I'm asking if it's true.
So what's the question?
Is there a Hasidish minhag to add a lot more ayin than what the RCA bins would do, let's say?
No, we would do the same thing. Meaning if you talk about last names, so a lot of people have a brace-like last name. So Rav Schachter spells his name Shin Chav Tes Resh, even though it really should be Shin Ayin Chav Tes Resh. I spell my name Zilberman Zayin Yud Lamed Beis Resh Mem Nun, even though it should be Zayin Yud Lamed Beis Ayin Resh Mem Aleph Nun. A lot of our last names have been abbreviated. But the correct way to spell Zilberman is Ayin Lamed Zayin Yud Lamed Beis Ayin Resh Mem Aleph Nun. So, but if I write a name of a place in a ksuba, or if I write a first name in a ksuba, so then you have to use a standard convention of how to write names. But last names are critical anyway, so you know, we accept that which has been Hebraicized,
okay,
or modern Hebraicized. But don't pick on the Hasidim, we write it the same way.
I like them.
Meaning if someone... If someone has a get, you know, get, we don't write last names in a get, but in the Pshur you write the last name.
Right.
So if someone has a way that they spell their last name, so they've accepted the Hebraicized version of the last name, so you write it the Hebraicized way. If someone doesn't spell their last name in Hebrew, you have a non-religious person who doesn't spell the last name in Hebrew, so then we write it the conventional way. So usually what comes out is that the religious people of Gittin have more Hebraic-sized last names than the Torah, and the irreligious people, because they don't have a way of spelling the last name in Hebrew, so then we write it the traditional way. Be that as it may. For a Shem Loazi that ends in a Patach, so the name would end with an Aleph, like Vega or Shena. You write an Aleph at the end as opposed to a Hebrew name where you would write a Hey at the end. And the correct spelling of names like Lev or Feg or Shena is with a single U, not a double U. Even if you have a Mifta, that you pronounce it more like an I than an A. But the more correct, the whole discussion in both come about this, but the more correct spelling is a single U as opposed to a W. Okay. Let's say you have a Hebrew name that appears in Tanakh. So generally the way that we spell such a name is the way it appears in Tanakh. So if you have a name that could be written in theory both Mali or Chaser and appears in Tanakh always Mali, always Chaser, so then we write a Chaser, even if the person writes his name Mali, because that's generally presumed to be a Chasim of Betos. That's a mistake. So let's say...
Boaz.
You have the name Boaz. So Boaz never appears in Tanakh Mali, it's always Beis Ayin Zayin. So even if a person thinks that his name is Boaz Beis Vav Ayin Zayin, and he writes his name Beis Vav Ayin Zayin, that's a mistake, because Boaz never appears in the Vav. So definitely to come to a get, and Ksuba as well. If a person signs his name in a way that's clearly wrong, so Ksuba should be written the correct way, not the incorrect way. So Boaz should be written Beis Ayin Zayin. There's some names... Yeah? There are some names that appear sometimes Mali or Chaser, so then there may be a default way of spelling it, but if the person has a tradition to spell it the other name, the other way, then you spell it the way that that person spells it. So let's say Binyamin. Binyamin could either be spelled Beis Nun Yud Mem Yud Nun, or it could be spelled Beis Nun Yud Mem Nun. Both are valid spellings. The default spelling is with two nuns. Sometimes you ask a person whose name is Binyamin, how many yuds do you spell it with? So they say obviously two yuds, meaning they think you're asking them, do you spell it Beis Nun Yud Yud? That's not the question. Is it Beis Nun Yud Mem Yud Nun or Beis Nun Yud Mem Nun? So most people spell it with two yuds. That's the default spelling, but some people spell it with one yud, and then if they spell it with one yud, that's a legitimate spelling. You write it with one yud, the name Dove. So just called me earlier today to ask how you spell, what's the default spelling for Dove? So the default spelling for Dove is Dalet Vav Beis, but if he has a tradition that he spells without a Vav, then you write without a Vav. So this, the Rav who just called me is being inside of Kedusha next week for two different Doves. One of them spells his name Chasser, one of them spells his name Malik. So you can write in the Tzuba the way the person spells it. We had, yeah.
When it comes to Edom, are we makid on them spelling
the name? Edom should spell the name correctly also. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Willard points out that for the Edom Aksuba, if it's not someone who is a professional signer, then it's a good idea for the Masada Kedushin to ask the person to practice his name before he signs it, to make sure he knows how to spell his name. We once did a get for a person whose name was Itai, like Itai Agiti. So Itai in Tanakh usually appears with one yud, but in one place it usually appears with one yud, but in one place in Dirayam it appears with two yuds. So this guy was chosim, I think it was Israeli, he was chosim with two yuds. So he wrote it with two yuds because it does appear that way in Tanakh, even though that's a minority appearance most times it appears with a single yud. There are some exceptions to this. The name Penina. The Penina, we write Pei Nun Yun Nun Hei, even though in Tanakh it appears Pei Nun Nun Hei, at the beginning of Shmuel. So we write it with a Yud because our name Penina is not supposed to be named after the biblical character. Because Penina in Tanakh was not a, it might have been justified for what she did, but she didn't act appropriately. So when we name the name Penina, it's not after the biblical Penina. Distinguish from the biblical Penina, we write it with the yod. Or let's say you have the name Tzipora, so we should have written Tzipora at Sadi Pei Reshe, because it always appears Chaser, but we write it with a Vav, not to confuse it with the name Tzifra. There was a name Tzifra, it's not so common anymore, but if you were to write Tzipora at Sadi Pei Reshe, you might think it's Tzifra, and then you get confused. So we write Tzipora with a Vav to distinguish it between Tzifra and Tzipora. The sefer that we use most, we don't follow this 100%, but one of the most authoritative sfarim on Shemos and Seder again is the Gemara Seder. So that's a good resource to have. He has the whole second section, second half of the sefer, is what are conventions for various Shemos and what different permutations exist. So he discusses all the names, what's acceptable, when do you follow the chasima, when is the chasima of the toes, etc. Okay. I think we left off last time discussing how to write the name of a chasim or kala whose father was not Jewish. So a related question is how do you write the name of an adopted child? Adopted child who wasn't converted, adopted from the birth parents were Jewish. If the adopted child wasn't born Jewish and then had a gerus, so then you treat them like a ger or gerus as far as writing the names. But let's say you have an adopted child whose birth parents were Jewish, or an adopted child, or you have someone who was raised by a step parent. So how do you write the name? How do you write the name in a ksuba or in a get? So there's a tshuva printed. The Aruch HaShulchan has a letter to Reb Aaron Gordon. Reb Aaron Gordon, we quoted when we learned Erevin, he was a Rav on the Lummi side in the beginning of the 20th century, the Elder Veda of Rabbi Reblaski and Rabbi Zatz. So we quoted his tshuva on the Erevin on the Lummi side, Bishaito, but he was known as a Mesader Gittin of Avdin Bezer matters, and he has a few svarim on Eben Ezra topic. So one of those svarim is the Eben Meir. And in the Hafdamah to the Eben Meir, he has a correspondence with the Aruch HaShulchan. He sent the Shiloh to the Aruch HaShulchan in 1907 regarding a get that was Gordon with Masadar in New York for a woman whose natural-born father was named Labush. And at the time of the get, they didn't realize that she was adopted, and they included the name of her adoptive father, Shmuel Leib, no relation to Leibush. So the Shaila was, La'achar Maisa, the get had already been delivered, and they realized that the name that they used was the name of the adoptive father, not the natural-born father. So the Aruch HaShulchan, in his response to Gordon, which was reprinted a number of years ago, someone came out with a collection called Tshuvas, the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan never printed a volume of Tshuvas, but this person was malakeh at everything that the Aruch HaShulchan had written that was printed in various other svarim and put it together one volume. So this Tshuva appears in that volume. I don't remember what the volume is called, but something like Tshuvas Aruch HaShulchan. So the Aruch HaShulchan has a number of reasons to be mekel b'di'evet in this get situation. Number one, even though most Rishonim assume that when it comes to a get, Shinui b'shem ha'apostles, if you make a mistake in the name of the father of the Baal or the Niskareshes and the apostles of the get, if you leave out the name entirely of the father, that's kasher. That we discussed last time, that might be an option. If you don't know the name of the father, it definitely would be by Shtuki, or if it's a suffix. But let's say if you wrote the father's name, so then it's clear in Tosfos and other Rishonim, that possible would be the Eved. If you made a mistake, if you wrote the father's name, you made a mistake. But there is a minority opinion, Rishon of the Bala Itter, that Ashina B'Shem Av doesn't hassle. So that's one sniff you throw into the mix. And then he says, the whole psul of Shina B'Shem Av may only be a psul Darabban and not a psul Daraisa. Again, so number one, there is a Dain Rishon in that a psul B'Shem Av doesn't hassle. Even if a hassles, it may only hassle Darabbanan. So that still doesn't get us home free. And then he says, what's the reason for the psul of the Shina B'Shem Av? So the Rashi explains that the reason if you have a Shina B'Shem Av apostles is that people may get confused. They want to understand who this person is. You write the wrong father's name, so they'll think we're talking about a different Miskareshes. In this case, you could argue the opposite. In this case, everyone knows her as the daughter of the adoptive father. People don't know who the natural born father is, so they would more readily identify her as the daughter of the natural born, of the adoptive father than of the natural born father. So maybe that whole chashash, why Shina B'Shem Av apostles, wouldn't apply in such a case. And then he says, in this particular case, maybe it wasn't such a big shinoi because the correct name was Leib, and here it was Leibush, and here they were Shmuel Leib, so half of the name is the same. And then, how do we really know who her father is anyway? Maybe she got her. Maybe Leibush really is the name of her adoptive father, because how does she know his proper Jewish name? So all these snifim are snifim, but you put it all together, the Aruch HaShulchan is comfortable being mako in this case, La'achar Maisa, where the get was written with the name of the adoptive father, not the name of the natural born father. Chuvas Tzitz Eliezer, Chelek Dalet Siman Kaf Beis, Tzitz Eliezer, Chelek Dalet Siman Kaf Beis, quotes this Aruch HaShulchan and agrees with him lehalacha. So that's all a matter of b'di'evet. What would you do if you wrote the name of the adoptive father? What should you do lechachila, Avi?
In that situation, yeah. The get shayla, wouldn't there be a problem with not having written that word lishma? How would the get need to be written lishma?
It is written lishma. Lishma means that I'm writing the get with the intent that it's for this woman. It's still for this woman, even if I got her name wrong. They got her father's name wrong. This is the woman in front of me. That's not a chisar of lishma. That's maybe a talus in the Shem Av, but the lishma it still is.
Okay.
Good. So what do you do with chachila? That was all a discussion of what happened with the epic. So what's the correct way to write the name? So the most correct way to write the name is to write the name of the natural born father. If you know the name of the natural born father, then you write the natural born father. And if you don't know the name of the natural born father, then you leave it out entirely. That's what a shtuki is. A shtuki is someone that you don't know the name of the father, you don't know who the father is. If you don't know who the father is, then you don't write a shema av entirely. And the Minchas Yitzchak writes this in the context of a ksuba. Chelak Heisim and Mendalid Minchas Yitzchak, Chelak Heisim and Mendalid. He says that's the correct course of action if you have an adoptive child. So you write the name of the natural born father, and if you don't know the name of the natural born father, then you write nothing. You don't write a Shema Av at all. Refelder, the Nachalat Tzvi, page Lamed Dalet. The Nachalat Tzvi, page Lamed Dalet. See, he agrees halfway with the Minchas Yitzchak. He thinks that if you know the identity of the natural born father, then you should write the name of the natural born father. Let's say you don't know the identity of the natural born father. So then he thinks that even Lechakila, in that kind of a situation, you can write the name of the adoptive father. Because the whole point of writing the father's name is to identify the party, and this is someone who is identified as the son or daughter of this adoptive father, so it's not wrong, even l'chachila, to write the name of the adoptive father. That's what Felder suggests. If you know who the natural born father is, better to write, then you should write that name. If you don't know, then you can even l'chachila write the name of the adoptive father. There's a Tshuva Sefer called Emek She'ela, not the Nitziv. Emek She'ela was written by a son-in-law of the Divrei Chaim of the Tzan Zerav, Rav Mordechai Dov Tursky. So the Tshuva Emek She'ela, which is actually printed before that Tshuva the Aruch HaShulchan. So he writes, in a case of an adoptive child, to write the following. In the case where there's an adoptive child that we didn't know the name of the natural born father, he says to write, Chaim Demiskeri Chaim Ben Avner. Now, Avner is the adoptive father, so he should write Chaim, called Chaim Ben Avner. That's what he would say to write him again. Chaim, Demiskeri Chaim Ben Avner. He's not really Ben Avner, but he's called Ben Avner. So write Chaim, called Chaim Ben Avner. And the Minchas Yitzchak agrees with that in a case of Sakana. What's the Sakana? So Chelek Vav Simen Kuf Nun Aleph. Chelek Vav Simen Kuf Nun Aleph. He's talking about a ksuba, where there is an adopted Kala. The Kala was adopted. And what's a Chashash Sakana? It's Chashash Sakana is that she didn't know she's adopted. And if she'd come to the wedding and hear under the ksuba name of someone else, then she would possibly have a mental health breakdown, and that wouldn't be a happy situation. So the Minchas Yitzchak refers to a concern of Sakana, that if the health of the Kala is at stake, then you could write Plonis Dimiskaria Plonis Bas Ploni.
Well,
you wouldn't read it under the ksuba. So, but if she pays attention later and then reads the ksuba at some point, so then maybe. I guess the assumption is that she wouldn't be. She's not going to read the ksuba. I think most women don't read their ksubas.
Right.
I'm pretty sure my wife never read the ksuba.
Once you're not reading it, so then
right.
No matter what you write.
No. What do you mean? Of course it matters.
Meaning then write whatever you want when she's not reading it.
Write what? That's what you're saying.
And just read it as something else on the book.
Once
right.
You're not reading the words.
Right, yeah, good. Good aura. Right here. I'm not sure. Not sure. Rabbi Sendragic raises the following question about this Asa. Ate the son of Simon Nun Aleph. So this suggestion of writing Ploni, the mystery of Ploni, and Ploni. So that works. If you have a shul-going person who gets called to the Torah, so if he's called to the Torah with the name of his adoptive father, you can say he's Chaim, the mystery Chaim ben Avner. But if he's never called to the Torah, nobody ever calls him Chaim ben Avner. So maybe that wouldn't work. If he's a shul-going person, he's called Chaim ben Avner, so then there's a situation in which he's honestly called Chaim ben Avner. If he's never called Chaim ben Avner, then maybe that wouldn't work. Rav Moshe has a tshuva. Yeah.
well, to define the mystery as being called the Torah. Maybe it's that people introduce him around town.
So whoever introduces him is Chaim ben Avner.
They introduce him as, oh, this is Avner's son. It's a little more colloquial, but...
So if that was the case, maybe. But typically...
People introduce their children. People
right.
introduce their parents.
Maybe. Okay. Okay. Maybe. Good. Your Moshe is the following Shuva. Chelek Aleph Evan Ezra Simon Sadi Tess. Chelek Aleph Evan Ezra Simon Sadi Tess. Who makes the following suggestion as to what to do in a Ksuba. You can write Ploni Ben Misha Nishkach Shmo Vinikra Ben Ploni Shtagibla. Again, Ploni Ben Misha Nishkach Shmo. So Chaim, the son of one whose name was forgotten, who is now referred to as Ben Ploni, who raised him. Chaim the Mishin Ishtakach Shmo, Vinikra Ben Ploni Shagibla. Our Abenzin, Rav Gedalia Schwartz, Shlita Shadar Fur Shlema, pointed out to me that the previous founding Abbas in the Bezin America, the brother of Rav Schleinberg, had a practice, even Lechachila, where there was an adopted child who didn't know the identity of his natural born father, of writing Ploni Hanikra Ben Ploni Hamagadlo. So Chaim Hanikra Ben Avner Hamagadlo. So so-and-so was referred to as the son of so-and-so who raised him. Parenthetically, that's a little bit difficult in a get, because in a get we write Lashon Habal, so it should have been Ploni Shegidlani. That's a little bit of a curiosity, but he would write Ploni Hanikra Ben Ploni and Megalo. So we had a case a number of years ago of an adoptive child who came for a get, and he knew who his natural born father was, but he absolutely insisted that we not write the name of his natural born father in the get, because he had tainus on him. Or maybe it was a case of someone that had a stepfather who didn't like his natural born father, and he insisted if you write the name of his natural born father in the get, then he's not going to participate, he's going to walk out. So in that case, we followed this suggestion of writing Ploni Ben Ploni Hamagabo. And Ploni Nicker Ben Ploni Hamagabo.
Is there a part of you write Ploni
Hanukkah,
Ploni Ben Ploni, or you just
are
Ploni Ben
Ploni Hanukkah? So our practice, based on Ramosha, this also, so our practice would be to write Hamagadlo.
Okay,
I haven't seen the...
Is the Nikra part, you have to say...
Well, no, so it's not... No, you say, can you say Ploni Ben Ploni Hanukkah instead of Ploni Hanukkah Ben Ploni Hanukkah?
Yeah. I'm just asking if that's how...
So he's not really Ben Ploni, so it's a little bit not true, because he's not really Ben Ploni Megabo. He's Hanikra Ben Ploni Megabo. So it's definitely something that's a possibility. If there's a sensitivity against writing the natural born father, then that is an asa to write Ben Ploni Megabo. That comes up every now and then. Okay, for Gera Gio, it's an Uksubi, write Ben Avram Avinu Bas Avram Avinu. Just right, Ben Avram or Bas Avram is incorrect. It's not Ben Avram, it's Ben Avram Avinu. Okay, so let's go back to the Nusach HaKtuba. The Echa B'Shabbos, Shlosh Yamim, L'Chodesh, Mar Cheshva, Shnaz Chavishas, Alafim, Shvav, Yasa, Shem, Sheva, L'Bias Olam, Amin, Shadam, and Kan, in New York. Then we have in a standard Nachla Shiva Ksuba, it says Eich. In Rav Schechter's Ksuba, when Rav Schechter has a slightly different Nusach HaKtuba, which I sent out to you in an email just for your reference, the history behind it is when Dr. Steiner married off his first daughter. Dr. Steiner was a professor in Revel who retired a couple years ago, expert in Semitic languages. So he noticed some irregularities or mistakes in the Aramaic and the Ksuba, and he wanted to fix it up, so he partnered with Rav Schechter to draft a revised Nusach HaKtuba. So most of the changes made are Shifra de Shtara changes, slight changes in the Aramaic or the language. the most substantive change is that he adds before Eich on Ansadi. This is Lashon Eidim. So Anansadi, that we serve as Eidim, that, etc., etc. So Shaka is Anansadi there. Eich blank. So in Menachla Shiva, it appears as blank. Eich ploni ben ploni. Even though later on, every time the chasan is referenced, it says chasan denan. The first time it doesn't say chasan or chasan denan because he's not yet a chasan. In the RCA ksuba and the madrich, it says a chasan, but that's probably not so correct. Rav Shach in his ksuba and the ksuba kol chasa, he has some virgins that have a bachar. And the same thing by the kala, you don't write maras the first time. You just write amr lala adav v'solta. Okay, so a standard ksuba besula, this is the beginning of Simon Samathayim and Eben Ezer. And the Iker ksuba is Masayim. And for the ksuba of a grusha or almana, the Iker ksuba is, almana is 100. And then the Tosefet ksuba is half of whatever the Iker ksuba is. Simon Samathayim Seif Gimbal, a Gioras, the ksuba is mana. But a Gioras is Nisgaira Kusam the Gimel Shana V'Yamecha, there the Ksuba is Masayim, even though you still identify her as a Gioras. Okay, the Rama writes in Simon Samachlav Sifyat Aleph that you have to identify, if a woman is a Grusha, you have to identify that status in the Ksuba, and no one should come to make the mistake and think that she's Mutaris HaKohen. So the standard way of identifying that is referring to her instead of Basulta as Matrakta. And that's an indication that she's a Grusha and therefore Asura Lekoin. Okay, how do you identify a woman who's married for the first time but she's not a Basula? Let's say we know she's not a Basula. So in the Beit Shmuel, Simon Samachlav Sivkatan Cafe. Simon Samachlav Sivkatan Cafe. The Bishmuel says that you should write Ba'ulta. So if you're to write Ba'ulta, that doesn't sound so nice if you're reading it under the Chuppah. So even if you were to write it, you don't have to always read what you write, or there's the old strategic off. But nevertheless, many Afroanim assume you don't have to write Ba'ulta in this kind of a situation. In the Pesachei Tshuva, there's a Katan Ches. Pesachei Tshuva suggests writing Arusa instead of Basulta. So you don't write that she's a Basula, but you don't have to write Ba'ulta. And many of the practice of writing Issasa Da instead of Basulta. Writing Masayim in that case isn't such a problem. Moshe talks about this in others. That's Hetzchayvus Midas. The husband can be Hetzchayv himself whatever he wants, even if her ksuba, she's only entitled Nikra, didn't to a mana, but if the husband wants to be Hetzchayv himself to give more, he's allowed to give more. So writing Masayim in that kind of situation wouldn't be a problem. Rabbi Bleich quoted a Tshuva of the Chasam Sofer in Simon Kuflam Gimel, that the Chasam Sofer writes Simon Kuflam Gimel, that when he had a case of a Bula Tatmo, a woman who was marrying someone that she already, that she's no longer Basula, she was already living with the person that she's marrying, but they haven't yet a chuppah for the kiddushin. So then the Chasam Sofer writes that Hayisi Noag Litha Masayim. His practice was to write Masayim instead of not a mana, because that's the hischayvus of the husband. Rabbi Blaj just pointed out that's a little bit curious. The Chasam Sofer seems to be saying that this isn't something that only happened once. That Hayisi Noag, something this wasn't an uncommon occurrence. That's a historical note.
What was
the Chasam Sofer
did?
Chasam Sofer said, even if it's a Bula Tatma, you can still write Masayim.
Okay.
Good. So the Sefer Tzuva Kol Chasa recommends that by a Be'ulat Atzmo, meaning they were already living together, and now they're getting married halachically, or you had, they're already civilly married, and now they're having a Chuppah of Kiddushin, so then the best is to write Issa. He quotes in the footnote unnamed sources. He doesn't say who says this, but he says some people say that even in the case of Bula Sasma, you could even write the Sulta. Rabbi Bleich pointed out his shir, and that's not a good idea because you shouldn't write something you know to be sheker. If you don't know whether she's a psula now, you don't have to ask the question. But if you know the facts, so then that's not right to write sheker in the psula. Anyway, Issa or however you get around it. The standard notation instead of the sulta or a matraka when it comes to giores is giorta. Where there are sensitivities, there may be grounds to write issa there as well. If you still be identified as bas achim avinu, so then you know the yasir l'kuna component. But there may be grounds to write issa there as well, where there's a sensitivity. What about a grusha who's an almana? So by an almana we write armalasa, a grusha matrapta. So let's say you have a woman who's both a grusha and almana, so you have to write both. In the Piskei Tshuva, Sivkatan Ches, Simon Samachla, Sivkatan Ches, the Piskei Tshuva quotes the Tshuva Saradvaz, who was asked about a Gioris, who's also a grusha. So you had a Gioris, then she was married once and got divorced. And now she's remarrying. So do you have to identify her both as a Gioris and as a Grusha? So he says, at first glance, you should be able to write either one. Because what's the reason you have to identify someone as a Gioris to indicate that she's a Sula Kohen? Why do you have to identify someone as a Grusha to indicate that she's a Sula Kohen? But if the woman's a Sula Kohen anyway for one reason, then why should you have to mention the other reason? So it should be sufficient, the Radbaz starts by saying, it should have been sufficient to just write, let's say, matrapta. That indicates that she's a grushin, she's a sula kohen, and you don't add anything by writing that she's a gioris. But then he says, no, he thinks that you should write both. You should write gioris as well, because there might still be an afkamina. Let's say this woman is going to, down the road, marry a ger. So the daughter of a ger and gioris is a sula kohen. So if you only wrote matrapta, so we'll know that she's a Sula Kohen, but we won't know that if she marries a Ger, the door will be a Sula Kohen. So the Rebbe says maybe you should have to write both Matrafta and Giurta to indicate all the facts of the case. But he says once you write a Giurta, then there's no added reason to write Grusha. Because there's no woman that a grusha is going to be usher to that a gioris is an usher to anyway. So the Ritvaz's conclusion over there is that it's not either or. You'd have to write giorta, but you don't have to write matrapta. And then he says the same thing by an almana and a grusha. If you identify the woman as a grusha, so then there's no added need to identify her as an almana. Because there's no one that a grusha is, there's no added iser by being an almana. Okay, so that's a psak of the Ritvaz. If you have a grusha as a gioras, you should write giorta. If you have a grusha as a almana, you write grusha. In the Ksuba Kalchasa Paragir Alis if Kazayan, in Paragir Alis, he quotes the Nachal Shiv and others against the Radvaz that you should write both. You should write Matrachta Plonis Vasponi to have this Armalasa. You should identify your both as a Grusha Almani, you should identify a woman both as a Giorta and a Matrachta. when I discussed it with Rosh Hashter once, Rosh Hashter thought that Lemaisa, you should write both, even though he wasn't so convinced of the Svaras why that would be necessary.
Could have a Hakamina if we wanted to join the Dola. Or use Dola
and the Grusha is the Grusha is going to go also.
No, but you would have to write on Mana, which would be prohibited.
If you're writing Grusha, there's no that Almana is going to be a surita, then Grusha is not a surita. The other way would be a problem. Correct. Okay. The other notable change in Rosh Hashanah's ksuba is in the standard ksuba when it refers to the shibudim of the Baal. The standard lashon is b'chayai u'basar chayai, in my life and after my life. That really means in my life and after my death. So Rosh Hashanah changed that to b'chayai u'basar mosi, which is more frank, perhaps less. No euphemism. So my wedding, Rosh Hashanah, is Mitzvah Kedushin, and we use Rosh Hashanah Ksuba. So Rabbi Genesher, the Kornel Rav, who was a Chashuv Rav on the West Side, was Mechubed with Kriyas Ksuba, and I guess he wasn't so familiar with Rosh Hashanah Ksuba, the older Rav. When he got to Basar Mosi, he kind of paused and was a little bit confused as to what he was reading. That's the most... The other changes are very minor. You wouldn't notice unless you're really sensitive, but that's cycling on inside the Basar Mosi is the most jarring. Okay, the other thing you should know is that you can't have blank spaces in a ksuba, so if there are any blank spaces, you should be mitayetet, meaning you should draw a line in the middle of the line so that there's no possibility of zia, so you wouldn't be able to add in anything to the missing line. In theory, if you had a blank line in a document so someone could write it, and I owe you $1 million, so we want to avoid any potential for ziyah. Okay. So once a ksuba is written, it has to be signed. Before it's signed, there's a Kabbalah's Kinyan. So there has to be a Kabbalah's Kinyan on the part of the chasan. So the standard practice is that the Misadar Kedushin is Makna Isudur to the chasan, to indicate the chasan is accepting upon himself the ischadius of the ksuba. Most people don't carry handkerchiefs anymore unless you carry one for this explicit purpose, so you can use a pen also. So you give the Masada Kedushin gives his pen to the chasan as a Kabbalah's Kenyan. In the Sefer Ksuba Kol Chasa, he quotes from Rav Ozner and others. Rav Ozner is a tshuva, Siman Aleph in the back of Ksuba Kol Chasa. Rav Ozner thought that it's more correct that the Kabbalah's Kinyan should be done with the Sudr of the Edim and not the Sudr of the Misad HaKadushim. It would work if it's the Sudr of the Misad HaKadushim, but the Lechachila is that it should be the Sudr of the Edim, based on Asma and Halachos Nechoshim Mishpat, and he thinks that's the Mashmos of the Kanina Amine. But as far as I've seen, I don't think that's a common practice, at least in America. I can't think of any Seder Kedushin I've noticed where the Kabbalah's Kinyan was done with the Edim's Siddur as opposed to the Masada Kedushin Siddur. Okay.
That would be one of the Edim?
One of the Edim, yeah. So in Hilchos Shtaros, in Chosha Mishpat, which should apply to Ksuba as well, Ksuba is a Shtar, Chosha Mishpat Simen Mem Hei Seif Beis, Simen Mem Hei Seif Beis, it says in Shulchan Aruch that Edim have to read the Shtar before they sign it. Generally a good practice in life. You should read something before you sign it. The Shachter points out, even in Sifkat Nebeis, in the Chagra, not that way, the Shachter quotes other Rishonim, that it's not even good enough if someone reads the document to the Edim. In the Shulchan Aruch, it sounds like if someone's reading the document out loud to the Edim trusts the person reading it, so the Edim don't have to read it themselves. The Shachter quotes from the Rambam that even that wouldn't work. It's not enough to rely on someone else's representation. The Edim have to read the Shtar themselves. But it's clear in Shulchan Aruch that there's a presumption and there's a requirement that you have to read something before you sign it. Yeah.
But they even don't understand what they're reading.
That's a problem. They have to understand what they're reading. So then that's the job of the Masada Kedushin, to explain to them what they're reading. I was sitting on a detour once where one of the issues was someone had a tviya against a former employer for wiping his personal data. He had a personal device that had a company data on it, and when the employer wiped the company data, it also wiped his personal data. So the counterclaim was that when you downloaded the software that enabled wiping the data, that you signed or you clicked on the fact that you read all the agreement and you understand what you're getting yourself into, that the person has the right, so the employer has the right to wipe all the data. So one of the dayanim asked, does anyone actually ever read any of these things before they click? So in Shulchan Aruch, the assumption is that you should be reading something before you sign it or click on it. I was once asked to sign a ksuba at a wedding where the Masada Kedushin was a member of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, and he seemed to be getting very annoyed at me for insisting on reading the ksuba before signing it. I don't know why, but it's pretty clear in Shulchan Aruch that you're supposed to read this. So even in the Masada Kedushin tells you to sign without reading, and Shulchan Aruch says you have to read it first. Now the Rambam writes, yeah.
Shouldn't the Masada insist that the Eidim read it?
Yes, the Masada should insist that the Eidim read it. Usually if the Eidim don't know how to read, the Masada should read with them. That's usually a good practice. Yeah, and with the Chassan. The Chassan has to know what it means also.
Right. Yeah. I see more like Masada like tries to explain to like the Eidim who are
right,
and like just friends of the Chassan.
Right.
How much do you have to read the words, or can you just explain to them what's on this document? And like, in
I
this document, it shows the following, and you're staring at it.
I think they should read the words.
Translate word by word as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. It just takes an extra few minutes to the chazanish, which most Masada Kedushin don't do.
Right. So you could do it in advance. It doesn't have to. The chazanish is usually more than 5 minutes, and the ksuba's at the end when everyone's the band's all ready to start playing, and everyone's
right,
in a rush, and you're ready half hour late. So maybe the Masada Kedushin should find out ahead of time where the Eidim are and how to read it beforehand, so that there's usually a lot of downtime until you're up to, you find the ksuba, there's a lot of pressure to get moving. So you have time to prepare before that. Come a few minutes early and make sure everyone reads it ahead of time. So that was it. Now the Rambam writes to the end of Siman Samach Vav, Sifur Gimel. Chaver says, "V'malkam she'en regilim lachtam b'ksuba el haruim lahaid lo yachta mishe'en yadei likra." So the person who signs the ksuba has to know what he's reading. Agav, v'lachei mama aretz shavo lagarish v'amar acher kach shelo hevin masha yakasa b'tinaim of ksuba enu neman. So if an amaret comes when they're holding by divorce, and he says, "I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't realize what the ksuba obligated me in," he has no nemanus. The vada ha'edim lo chasmu masha lo ha'edim. So it's inconceivable that the Eidim would have signed in a document that's Mishayu of the Chassan without understanding that the Chassan agrees what he's getting himself into. So that's the Achrayus of the Eidim. It's not just the Kibud. It's not just that the Eidim have an Achrayus to make sure that the Chassan knows what he's getting into. It says in Hilchos Shtaros and Chosha Mishpat, Simin Mem Hei Sifav, Simin Mem Hei Sifav, that there can't be too much space between the last line of the document and the Chasimus of the Eidim. Because that's the Yachal Azai. If you can write in, again, I owe you $1,000,000 before the Chasimus. So if it's more than Shnei Shitin, if there's more than two lines between the end of the document and the Chasimus, that's Basel. That applies to the Ksuba as well. So how do the Eidim sign their names? You include a Shem Mishpacha. So in the Sefer Ksuba Kol Chasa, he quotes Parachas Ara Lama Gimel, Parachas Ara Lama Gimel. The way he says it is that most people don't include the Shem Mishpacha in the Chasima Sa'edim. And he quotes from Shlomo Zalman that even though Shlomo Zalman was inclined to include the Shem Mishpacha in the name of the Chasana Kala, but he said there's no need to include the Shem Mishpacha for the Eidim. Rav Shachter's Netiya is to include the Shem Mishpacha for the Eidim, and Rabbi Willig says not to include the Shem Mishpacha for the Eidim. So again, you have to, if you're signing a ksuba, you have to remember who the Masada Kedushin is.
Okay.
Rabbi Shapki thinks he should write the Shem Mishpacha, and Rabbi Willi thinks he should write the Shem Mishpacha.
The
Chasana Kal, the same. Rav Shapki thinks that if your father is a rabbi, then you should know that usually, and again, we never include honorifics neither for the Baal nor for the Avia Baal, not for the Isha, not for the Avia Isha. So, once we did a Seder Aged for a woman who was a conservative rabbi, and she wanted us to write rabbi in the get, so we told her we never write rabbi for anyone. It's not nothing personal. We don't include honorifics in the get. But in a Shtar, if the Chasima Seidim, or even in the Ksuba, so then Rav Shapki says that if your father's a Rav, you could be Chosem ben Harav. That's how Rav Shapki is Chosem. And Rabbi Willi, his father's also Rav, is not Chosem with the Rav by the Beit Hashem Av. So either way is probably fine. Then our practice is, this is not Ma'akid, but our practice is that before the Chasima Seidim we have the word Ne'um. The Eidei Ksuba have to be, yeah.
What about writing the mother thing?
That's not standard practice.
There are Dr. Vine who taught me to told us that we should.
Okay. That's not the standard way of writing a shtar. I don't think it's possible. Okay, so the Eidei Ksuba have to be Kasher Eidim. Kasher Eidim means this is Kosher Mishpat Simul Lama Gimel, whatever is normally a Kasher Eid. So it can't be a Karov and it can't be a Pasul. Pasul is the Baal Aveira. So you have to make sure that the Eidei Ksuba, we're not going to have time to talk about the actual Kedushin, but Kosher Kedushin, the Eidei Kedushin, can't be Karov and they have to be Kasher, they can't be Baal Aveira. So they have to be religious Jews. And they can't be krov. They have to be observant Jews, not Bali Avera, and they can't be krov. And what level of korva apostles? So there's Meikar Adin korva, and then there's Lachumer korva. So what we assume in Chosh Mishpat in Siman Lama Gimel, as far as levels of korva, is that Meikar Adin, for my purposes, Meikar Adin includes. Some of this may only be the Rabbanan, but a Sheni v'Sheni, the Ramah passes at least that a Sheni v'Sheni with two Baal Ke'ishtos should not be an Eid. What does Sheni v'Sheni mean? Sheni v'Sheni means second degree Korva, which is first cousins. So Rishon v'Rishon are brothers, and Sheni v'Sheni would be, let's say, first cousins. So a sheni v'sheni, even with two Baal Ke'ishtos, meaning you have, let's say, two first cousins who are both females, and they each marry their respective husbands. So the brother-in-laws, who are brother-in-laws through the same sisters, that's called the sheni v'sheni with two Baal Ke'ishtos. That the first cousin, the female first cousins are themselves sheni v'sheni, and then each one is married to each one that's a Baal Ke'ishtos. So a sheni v'sheni with two Baal Ke'ishtos should not be an aid, definitely l'chafila. And Rishon v'shlishi is machlokas rishonim, but we're machmir that also. Rishon v'shlishi would be, let's say, a grandparent and a great-nephew. And then Rav Shapki points out from Achronim that when it comes to Eidei Kedushin, he thinks Eidei Ksuba, you don't necessarily have to go this far. But by Eidei Kedushin, you should be machmir even for Rvi with Baal Ke'ishtos, even third cousins through marriage. So for Eidei Kedushin, the threshold is higher, at least l'chafila. Rav Shapki says that if it's a choice between using irreligious people or Rvi Rvi with the Baal Ke'ishtos, then you can use a Rvi with the Baal Ke'ishtos, but all things being equal, you should be machmir for Eidei Kedushin, at least in Eidei Aget, up to a Rvi. Okay, but you have to make sure, if you have the Mitzvah of Kiddushin, that the people who are signing are not related to each other and not related to the Chassan. My father was at a wedding this week out of town, so he called me after the Chassan Sish when I was walking to the Chuppah, and he said, they just signed the Ksuba, and they called up to sign the Ksuba. One of the Edom was the first cousin of the Kala. Is there any way that's okay? So I said, if he's adopted, maybe. So I said he should go over to the Masada Kedushin and ask if he heard right that it was the first cousin of the Kala. So he did hear right, and the Masada Kedushin was some Chabad rabbi who I guess was not sufficiently experienced to be Masada Kedushin, and he didn't know the din. He didn't know that there's such a thing as a Psul Korba. He didn't know that that's called the Psul Korba, Sheni B'Sheni. So they had to redo the Ksuba with the Kasher Edim, and they delayed the Chuppah. So you shouldn't make such a mistake. Now you know. The author of Poskim has a fascinating suggestion, he calls it some acronym, that I had never seen before. I just came across it this week. Ozer poskim simin mem bei sukkata mem hei ostes vav. Simin mem bei sukkata mem hei ostes vav. I, again, never saw this before. I don't think we're choshish for this, but he quotes a makronim who suggests that a shadchan would be possible to be an eight kedushin. And the ksuba kolchasa thinks an eight ksuba as well. Why? Psul nogeya. That he has a vested interest in the kedushin taking place, so he gets paid. So he says, if a shachan hasn't yet gotten paid, then he'd be pasul as an eight kedushin, and the ksuba kasa thinks he'd be pasul, according to this position, as an eight ksuba as well, because he's a nogei b'davar. He wants to get paid for the for his efforts. I don't know. I could think offhand of two instances in which I was a shachan and I signed the ksuba, and no one raised this issue. So I'm assuming that we're not really cautious for this. Otherwise, I have to go back. Might have a problem. Alex.
Right,
I'm sorry? Masada meeting. So that's another discussion. That's the next of Katan in the Arthur Poskim. So, classically, very often the Masada Kedushin traditionally would be an aid because he was the only other, there are only two from people there, especially Masada Kedushin for non-religious people. So, the Masada Kedushin would come and he'd bring along the Chazar, bring along something else as a Kasher aid, and they just didn't have the personnel. So often you would say, what's the possible objection? So maybe you'd argue that's also a psul nogei because he wants to get paid. Or the other issue is hanotel skar ladin, that notel skar ladin dina v'talim. If when a notel skar lahay dina is a nusa v'talim, the din is that if you take money to say edus or you take money to be a dayan, so then the din is batel and the edus is batel. So how do you parse it? The Masada Kedushin, is he taking money? What's he taking the money for? Is he taking the money, if he happens to be an eid, also taking money for the eidus? Is that really called a notel skar lahayit? Or is he taking money to oversee that everything is being done properly? He's not taking money for the, you're not paying him for the eidus.
You've never paid any of these.
Right.
So it's clearly just
on the seat there. Right. So you're not paying. So I think the common practice is not to be worried about this. About that issue, but it is discussed. Yeah, obviously.
If he was already paid, would that
change anything? Especially so these are say, yeah, if he was already paid, unless he's going to have to give the money back if the shit doesn't go through.
Michael? Is the one doing condition allowed to be a karov?
Is what?
Is the condition allowed to be a karov?
Ah, so that's what we mentioned last time. Rav Shapter points out that depends on whether Seder condition is viewed as a Maisa Bezdin. So Rav Shapter's Choshesh L'Chachila that the Seder condition should not be a karov. That's, we discussed that, we mentioned that briefly last time. Yeah. Rav Shapter points out in that context that when he was Masada Kedushin for his kids, or those that he was, he said there are other Chasher Rabbanim too. So as far as he's concerned, the other Rabbanim was a Masada Kedushin. Masada Kedushin doesn't have to mean the person said the prophet, the person is Achrai, that everything runs properly. So he was summoned from the other Rabbanim in the front row that they were, make sure that everything was done properly. But he tells a story that at his wedding, he had asked the Rav to do the Masada Kedushin. The Rav told Ramosha to Ramosha Feinstein to say the brachos.
I went to Rav Khan and Rav Aram, I think. Rav Aram was something also.
I'm sorry?
I think Rav Khan, both Rav Khan and Rav Aram were something also in that situation.
Okay. So the way Rosh Hashanah says it is that the Rav explained that he was beside the Kedushin. He filled up the cup of wine and he gave it to Ramosha to say the bracha. So he made sure that the Kedushin were running properly. Okay. I noticed, there's just a curiosity. Over the years, I've come across a few ksubos that were executed in Tehran before the revolution, some maybe even after the revolution. So apparently the practice in Tehran, there were not a lot of shomer mitzvahs in the community, it was a very traditional community in the later years. So there were a million chasimas on the ksuba. It wasn't just two people signed, everyone and their uncle signed. So everyone and their uncle signed, that's a Tzul Korba. But this actually has a source in the literature. The Beit Shmuel, who was not in Tehran, the Beit Shmuel writes here in the on the side of Shulchan Aruch in Sirkat and Chalches, Simon Samach about Sirkat and Chalches, that apparently some places had the practice where they would add Pasul Eide Mishim Kavod, that it was signing the suit was a kibbutz. We just said it's a responsibility too. It's a kibbutz, so they wanted to mechaber a lot of people. So they mechaber a lot of people to find the ksuba, even krovim. So that's not a psul, as long as you have the two kasher edim or sign. The other ones are just for the merriment involved, but don't passel the ksuba. So apparently that was the case in Tehran in recent years, or at least the last time they were making weddings in Tehran, they had all these chasimas. I haven't noticed that elsewhere. Yeah.
Vishnu saying they would add, but
the initial two were Sheirim, and then underneath everyone else signed.
But it's a clear point. He's saying that it was obvious which two were kosher. Or?
Yeah, he says that the first ones were on top, and the other ones were in the Persian subas. I've seen it's all over the place. I don't know how you figure out who's who. There is an institution called the Ksuba de Irkusa, a Ksuba that was lost. So what's the consequence of losing a Ksuba? So the wife always should know where her Ksuba is. What happens if she loses track of the Ksuba? So the Gemara has in Ksuba, and Dachman Baba Medez Nizayin and Manawa from Isa. After the Rami Barchama Havas Nesiva le Rav Avya. So the sister of Rami Barchama is married to Rav Avya. Irkus Ksuba, so she lost her Ksuba. Or her ksuba was lost, more accurately. Also, came to Rav Yosef, so they came to Rav Yosef to ask what to do. Amar lei, haki amar Yehuda amar Shmuel, zu divrei meir. Avachamim omri, masha adam is ishto, shlaim mishal hashanam lo ksuba. So Rav Meir is of the opinion that asa lishos adam ishto li ksuba. You're not allowed to be married at all without a ksuba. That's based on Remeir's position, Nandal and Nadei, at the beginning of the fifth parak, that called Pochis of Sula Masai Mamana Mana Reza Bilasna. So if you don't have the requisite guarantees of the Ksuba, then that's Bilasna. So the Gemara says based on that, but according to Remeir, if you are living, you're not allowed to live with your wife without a Ksuba. Why is that? So Rashi explains over there on Nzayin Amud Aleph. That's considered bilas nus because of a lack of smichas das. That if there's no ksuba, so the woman has a lack of smichas das, that if the marriage is going to fall apart, that she's not going to be cared for, so she doesn't want to be in such a marriage, and that's ki'ilu, or that's considered bi'ilas nus. Shuvas HaRashba, the Rashba has a slightly different perspective. For example, Shuvas HaMiyuchas HaSimin Reish Pei Dalid. Shuvas HaMiyuchas HaSimin Reish Pei Dalid, that if you don't have the Ksuba, Svuri he came and she'enu noigim ha-kabal, enu nasim begerishim, that she is concerned that since he hasn't fulfilled his obligations as a Baal by giving her Ksuba, so he already has a mind to divorce her, and that's Kigmusha Salev, and that's Ki'ilu Be'ilasness. Right, so that's the Gemara in Baal Bekam and Peites and Aleph for Meir, that also Adam Sheyishas Ishto Apilu Sha'akas Lo Ksuba, Shalotehe Kala Be'ena Vlotzia. That you're not allowed to be living together with your wife even for a moment without a tzuba because shalote kala beina vlotzia. The Rashba there explains bava kama peites that shalote kala beina vlotzia bilosness is really one and the same. That since the woman thinks that if there won't be any financial consequences to divorcing her, he'll readily divorce her. So then that's ki ilu bilosness. So bottom line. Din is that absent a ksuba, if a ksuba is missing or lost, the husband and wife are not allowed to live together. The Sefer Mishpat HaKsuba. Mishpat HaKsuba is a voluminous work written very recently on the Hilchos HaKsuba. So there he has in Chelek Zayin, he quotes from a Tshuvas Radbaz that let's say you have a shtar ksuba which is written but not signed. He quotes the Radbaz as saying that as long as the ksuba is written, even if it's not signed, that's not a violation of Asher Lishas Lo Ksuba. And apparently that was a practice in Egypt. The Radbaz was in Egypt initially, or one time. That was a practice in Egypt that they would sign, that they would only sign the ksuba the morning after the chasana. So he points out that that only makes sense if, where we have such a practice. If you're in a community where the ksuba wasn't signed until the next morning, so then you could argue that there's sufficient because of that. But if the practice is to sign it on the spot, so then you can't argue that just having it written without signed creates a level of smichus das. Alex, yeah.
But the requirement is just to know where the ksuba is, not to have it in.
You have to be holding it, right.
Right.
But now you have to have access to it or be able to access it.
Right.
So there's a, in the Minhagim Aril, Nisuin Osiv Gimel, Minhagim Aril, Nisuin Osiv Gimel, he writes the following, that there is an episode, an instance where a sofer sees the ksuba in lieu of payment. They commissioned the fancy ksuba, and they didn't pay for it yet. So the sofer insisted that he's not giving over the ksuba until they pay for the ksuba. So they're at the wedding, and the ksuba is being held hostage. So the Maril, the Mahagim really writes, Arule Avi Hakala, so the father of the Kala said to the sofer, Taniach Lachdom Eidim, so why don't you at least let the Eidim sign the ksuba, and then you'll hold it until the chasan pays you. The Maril said, that doesn't help. Because in order to avoid this problem of Asalisha Sluksuba, she has to have ready access to it. So even if you know that it exists, but you don't have access to it, that's a violation of Asalisha's Sluksuba. In the Barhetiv, here in Simon Samachvav, in Sagan Michael, the Barhetiv Simon Samachvav, Siv Kazan Gimli quotes other Rachronim who argue on this Maril, that if you know where it is, even if you can't access it, that's not a violation of this din. What about where you know that you have a ksuba in your house, you just can't find it right now. You're not organized. You know it's there somewhere, but you can't find it. It's not where you thought it was, but you know it's in the house. So the Mishpat HaKsuba quotes from Rav Chaim Kanievsky and Rav Osner that that's not called loss. Loss means that you really don't know where it is. If you know it's here, you just can't find it at this moment. That's not called lost. Michael.
I may have gotten the Gemara confused, but there came Gemara where the girl selling the ksuba that the husband dies, she gets the ksuba money.
Yeah.
So in that case, does she not have ksuba? And then the ksuba can only do the person she sells ksuba over to?
So then there might be another that other the lien or the shivan on the ksuba. I mean, there still is a ksuba. and there are still consequences for, even if the money is going to go somewhere else, there's still consequences to the husband for, you know, she won't get the money, she'll also get the money, but the husband will still pay the money.
So I can't say the same thing in this case, that the sofer will get the money because he's holding on to suva.
So he can't get the money. Suva is the hischayvus of the baal to the isha. Right? So, if you come across such a situation where a ksuv is lost, so then there's a separate nusach, which is a ksuv de irkasa, and that should be executed as soon as possible without delay to avoid this problem of asur lishos below ksuva. There's also something called the ksuv de shakach bat usa, where there's a mistake found in the ksuva, a fatal mistake. So then there's a nusach of ksuv de shakach bat usa, which also should be done as soon as possible. In both of these situations, both in a ksuba de irkasa, if you find the original document later, or a ksuba de shtaka batusa, so the document of record is a later document and not the earlier document. Okay, I think we're going to wrap things down here. As I emailed earlier, I'd like you to listen to the two shiurim I sent out, one from Rashachter on Seder Kedusha, one from Rabbi Wilgam Prenups. I'm sorry we didn't get to the actual what happens after the Chassid Tish, but I guess you'll have to figure that out on your own. Okay, it was a pleasure learning with you this year. The Bechina should be available whenever you want to take it. I hope to have it by the beginning of next week, and you can email me. I'll send it to you when you're ready. And for those